The moose fell after a few meters, kicking furiously. Each blow of its hooves dug furrows in the ground. Then it collapsed on its side, trembling until its breath ceased. "We have to open it up," said Carlo. Enrico nodded. Carlo cut into its belly with a long, deep gash. The entrails slid out suddenly, steaming in the cold air. The smell was nauseating, a mixture of dung, bile, and warm blood. Their hand sank into the animal's body, freeing the heart and liver. The ground was stained red, and a trickle ran down to a puddle, coloring it like dark wine. A howl echoed in the distance. Wolves. Yellow eyes appeared between the tree trunks. There was no time. They cut off the thighs and back and abandoned the rest. When they moved away, the pack pounced on the carcass. The sound of teeth breaking bones filled the clearing. Jaws snapped shut with sharp clicks. Throats emitted low growls. Shreds of flesh were torn off and thrown to the ground, and the smell of blood and wet fur mingled with the echo of howls. Enrico watched the scene and said quietly, "That's what they'll do to us if we're not careful." Carlo nodded, his face grim. "That's why we have to go further. Staying here is like being that carcass." The return to the village was accompanied by the weight of bloody thighs and the gaze of children running to watch. The women washed the meat in the river. The water immediately turned pink, then red. The mothers' clothes were stained up to their elbows, and the iron smell mingled with the dampness of the river. Amelie helped rinse the pieces, and every time she dipped her hands in the cold blood, she felt a retching sensation. Etienne touched her arm. "Don't look back. This is how we live. This is how we resist." She nodded, pressing her lips together. Marie dipped her pen and wrote, "Today I saw the blood of men and animals flowing into the same earth. The forest watches and says nothing. But I fear it remembers." The evening fell thick. Around the fire, the wounded gasped for breath, bandaged in dirty rags. The boy struck by the arrow lay pale, his thigh blackened by the burn of the iron. Every now and then, he opened his eyes and groaned. The second, struck in the arm, was delirious, and pus continued to ooze from his wound. The smell filled the hut, mixed with sweat and fear. Outside, the village huddled together. The women salted the moose meat, the children were silent, and the men cleaned their weapons with trembling hands. Every blow of the hammer, every spark from the fire, was a sign that they were still resisting. Yet behind the trees, invisible eyes continued to watch. It had not been an attack, but a warning. The blood spilled was only the prelude. The Iroquois were waiting. The Wooden Village. The snow had melted a few weeks earlier, and the land around the small settlement along the San Lorenzo River gave off the acrid smell of freshly turned earth and rotting leaves, a harbinger of summer. The days had grown longer, and the sky, clear and taut like a blue cloth, cast a harsh light on the wooden huts and newly erected palisades. The previous year had left deep scars, men torn apart by Iroquois blades, women forced to watch over charred corpses after sudden fires, children disappearing into the forests, dragged away without a cry. None of the settlers were unaware of the fragility of their existence. But with spring came the need to work, to build, to hunt, to sow. No one could afford to stand still, because hunger and winter knew no mercy. Etienne Moreau led a group of men and boys along the path that ran alongside the river. Walking beside him was Carlo, with his bow slung over his shoulders and his quiver well stocked with arrows. Behind them, two young men who had just arrived from La Rochelle carried rifles they did not yet know how to handle with confidence, while Enrico brought up the rear with his sure footing and knife at his belt. They had pushed north, where the trees thinned out and game was abundant. They needed meat. Their supplies of smoked char and corn were running low, and the community was clamoring for fresh game. However, the journey was risky. Several times in recent weeks, suspicious movements had been noticed in the forest, traces of furtive passages, feathers and symbols left as warnings along the tree trunks. The Iroquois had not ceased their vigilance. The first prey fell in the morning. A young deer, struck in the side by one of Carlo's arrows, and finished off with a shot from Etienne's arquebus. When the animal fell to the ground, kicking furiously in the blood spreading across the grass, the French boys were petrified. The deer emitted a deep rattle, its nostrils swollen with red foam, while its legs kicked futilely. Henry, without hesitation, bent down and plunged his knife into its throat, causing a warm jet to spurt out, staining his hands and the surrounding grass. The silence became heavy, interrupted only by the moans that died away in the gurgling of blood. "Look closely," he said firmly to the two younger boys. "This is how the beast dies, and this is how you must learn to finish it without hesitation. If you let it suffer, it will attract predators and enemies. Hunting is never mercy. It is necessity." The boys swallowed, pale, but no one dared to reply. One of them bent down to touch the still warm body and immediately withdrew his hand, as if burned. They cut the carcass carefully, opening it from the belly. The acrid smell of entrails spread through the air, mixed with the steam rising from the still warm guts. The liver, extracted and placed on a maple leaf, dripped dark red. The lungs, soft and swollen, gurgled when Etienne grabbed them. Carlo, with confident gestures, separated the good meat from the offal. Enrico skinned the animal with quick, precise strokes, leaving the fur almost intact, useful for new blankets or for covering the shacks. The whole scene was a ritual, and the young men watched in silence, struggling to suppress their nausea. The journey continued for several more hours, with the sun rising high and mosquitoes beginning to harass their sweaty faces. At times, the forest seemed hostile, sudden rustling, shadows darting between the trunks, the constant feeling of being watched. Several times Carlo raised his hand to impose silence, listening intently. It was not just paranoia. Anyone who had lived more than one winter in those lands learned to recognize the invisible footsteps of hidden men. In the middle of the afternoon, they reached a clearing where an imposing elk was grazing peacefully. The wind was favorable, and the men arranged themselves in a semicircle. It was Enrico who shot the arrow that pierced the beast's side. The animal let out a deep bellow and tried to flee, but Etienne's musket shot made it stagger. The elk staggered, then fell to its knees, bleeding profusely. The scene that followed was brutal. The animal, still alive, tried to get up, its legs scraping the ground, its eyes wide with terror. Carlo mounted it and plunged his dagger into its skull, between its horns, pushing until the body gave way, shaken by violent spasms. The blood formed a large, black, steaming pool in the tall grass. Flies swarmed, attracted by the iron smell. When they ripped open its belly, a stream of warm sewage flowed down to their boots, and one of the young men couldn't take it. He vomited to the side, doubling over. Enrico laughed bitterly. "Better to lose your stomach now," he said, "than in front of an enemy in battle." They dragged the carcass to the river to wash it, but when they reached the bank, the current carried unusual debris, a torn leather sandal and a colored feather. Everyone stood still. These were not traces of game. Etienne picked up the feather and studied it for a long time. "We are not alone," he murmured. The tension was palpable. No one dared speak aloud. Carlo and Enrico exchanged a quick, knowing glance. They understood the warning. The Iroquois had left signs of their presence, and if they had come close enough to throw remains into the river, it meant they were watching closely, perhaps already ready to ambush them. It was decided to return. The meat was placed in rough sacks and distributed among the men. The return journey was made at a rapid, nervous pace, with weapons at the ready. Every creak in the forest seemed like a prelude to an attack, and the younger boys were on the verge of panic. But the evening passed without incident, and only when they caught sight of the settlement's palisades did they breathe a sigh of relief. The village welcomed them with great excitement. Women and children ran to meet them, happy to see so much meat brought home. But Etienne's grave expression quickly dampened their enthusiasm. He turned to Jean Talon, who had arrived shortly afterwards. "We heard them nearby. We cannot let our guard down." The governor nodded, his lips pressed tightly together. Too many times already had the nights been broken by sudden screams and burning huts. That evening, in the flickering light of the fire, Amélie Rousseau helped prepare the meat. Her slender hands were reddened by the moose's blood, but her face remained serene. Every now and then she looked up at Etienne, who was talking to Carlo and Enrico. Her heart was filled with a strange mixture of fear and pride. Fear for the men who were risking their lives, pride in the courage shown by her husband, who was now increasingly respected by his companions. The Filles du Roi, gathered around the fires, shared their impressions of the day, while some sang French songs to cheer themselves up. Marie Lefebvre, sitting a little apart, wrote in her diary by the flickering light of the torch. She noted details, sensations, smells, as if she feared that the world would quickly forget the trials they had endured. The pages were filled with raw descriptions, the stench of coagulated blood, the color of entrails, the sound of fallen bodies. She did not write to please, but to pass on. She knew that one day someone would have to read and understand the price that had been paid to conquer those lands. During the night, when all seemed quiet, a sudden cry pierced the silence. A young settler, standing guard on the palisade, had fallen, an arrow stuck in his shoulder. The bone tip had pierced the flesh, breaking his collarbone. The boy writhed and screamed as blood ran down his arm. The men rushed over, torches in hand. A hiss of ferocious laughter came from the forest, followed by the rustling of branches closing back together. Etienne and Carlo lifted the wounded man, while Enrico and two others fired shots into the darkness. The acrid smell of gunpowder mingled with the sweetish stench of blood. The women rushed over. Amélie brought linen cloths to staunch the wound. Marie held the torch with trembling hands. "We have to remove the tip," said Carlo, his voice harsh. They immobilized him. Enrico, with a sharp knife, cut the flesh around the arrow. The young man screamed as if his soul were being torn out. His teeth gritted, his eyes rolled back. Warm blood spurted from the cut, mixed with shreds of muscle. Enrico clenched his jaw, grabbed the wood and pulled it out with a sharp tug. A red spray splattered his face, which remained impassive. Amélie pressed the bloody rags onto the wound, while Marie mentally noted every detail, knowing she would later commit it to paper. The air was thick with screams, smells, fear. But the boy survived, gasping for breath and white as wax, and was laid down in a hut. No one slept that night. Torches burned around the palisade, and muskets remained loaded. In the forest, every now and then, a rustle or a distant howl reminded them that the eyes of the Iroquois had not closed. And so the day ended. With the moose meat hung up to dry, the blood still fresh on the ground, a boy mutilated but alive, and a village breathing in the rhythm of fear. But along with the fear, determination also grew, and everyone, looking at the fire, understood that this land would be defended to the last breath. Wooden roofs and smoke. The next morning, the village awoke under a milky sky where the sun struggled to break through. A persistent smell of stale smoke rose from the huts, mixed with that of heated resin, as if the beams themselves were breathing ash. The roofs, still wet with dew, dripped slowly, and the water ran down the blackened shingles, leaving greyish trails. Everything seemed impregnated, clothes, blankets, hair, even the children's skin. It was the smell of a village that had lived too close to the flames, of men and women who could not forget the night just past. Amélie Rousseau looked out from her hut, clutching her apron to her chest to protect herself from the cold wind. She looked at the wooden roofs, some repaired as best they could, others covered with branches and clods of earth. She said to herself, "We breathe smoke more than air." She then felt a pang of nostalgia for La Rochelle, for the smell of the sea and wet nets, but that image quickly faded, replaced by the realization that here, in the heart of the continent, the sea was now just a memory. Marie Lefebvre approached her with a bucket of water. Her hair fell loosely over her shoulders, damp with dew, and her eyes showed deep, dark circles. "I didn't sleep a wink last night," she murmured. "Every creak of the logs sounded like an enemy's footsteps. But the boy, he's still breathing." Amélie nodded. "Yes, he's breathing, and that's more than we could have hoped for." The young man wounded the night before, who had been shot in the shoulder, lay in a hut nearby. The cauterization had left an unbearable smell of burnt flesh, but the wound was no longer bleeding. The boy was gasping for breath, feverish, but alive. Meanwhile, the men were already gathering in the village square. Etienne Moreau, with his axe on his shoulder and his hair tousled by the wind, spoke up. "The roofs are not holding. Last week's rains have caused water to leak into at least 5 huts. If we want to survive the coming winter, we must repair them now." Carlo, sitting on a log, nodded. "Every crack is an invitation to ruin. The wind gets in, smoke builds up, and if a spark escapes from a hearth, we'll find ourselves with huts on fire again." And the children cough at night, added Claire Dupuis, who was holding her little one in her arms. The smoke is too thick. If we don't fix the chimneys, our own fires will suffocate us. Etienne gave a decisive nod. Then no one goes out hunting today. Everyone to work on the roofs. The defences remain with armed sentries, but the priority is to secure the houses. The men dispersed into small groups. Some climbed the log ladders, others prepared straightened nails on the anvil, and still others mixed resin and pitch in steaming pots. The village began to buzz with activity. Carlo and Enrico worked together on the roof of the central hut. Enrico, spreading the pitch with a wooden spatula, said, "This village is like a wounded body. Every shingle we fix is like a suture. If we leave a crack open, death will enter." Carlo smiled slightly. "You talk like a surgeon." "And you like a poet," replied Enrico, hammering a crooked nail with a precise blow. "But we don't need surgeons or poets here. We need hands that can hold." Below them, Amelie and Marie were preparing buckets of water to pass around in case of fire. Marie looked up at Carlo and said, "Be careful. I saw a crack in the chimney. If the wind changes, a spark could escape and set the roof on fire." "We've already seen it," replied Carlo. "We'll seal it with stones and mud. Don't worry." The work was hard. The sun, though pale, warmed their backs and made sweat drip into their eyes. Each blow of the hammer resounded like a drum in the tense silence of the forest. The women sewed clothes, patched sacks, and brought water and food to the men on the roofs. The children ran between the huts, laughing at times, but always under the watchful eye of their mothers. Mid-morning, a group of hunters arrived dragging the carcass of a black bear. The animal had been killed after a fierce fight. One man had his thigh torn open by a deep scratch. They took the wounded man to the medical hut. Amelie followed him with Marie. When they lifted the makeshift bandage, the cut revealed white fat under the skin and blood trickling slowly.